Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello, you gorgeous lot. Welcome to a new mini-series from the lovely people at History Hack. I'm Charlotte White, but you can call me Charlie, and this is Misunderstood. I'll be joined by a stellar lineup of guests who are each going to help me explore the lives of women who've perhaps been dealt an unfair hand by history. They may not all be great women who changed the world. They may not all be good women, but they will all be interesting. Some have been forgotten, some ignored, some misrepresented, but they have all been misunderstood. Catherine Curzon is a royal historian specialising in the Georgian period, and she's also the writer of several best-selling novels set during World War II under the pen name Ellie Curzon. More importantly, she's the creator of all things hashtag frockingfabulous on Twitter. She's here today to discuss one of the most important figures in the British monarchy, who you won't find listed amongst our monarchs, Sophia, the Electress of Hanover. Hello, Catherine.
Hello, thank you for having me. I'm so excited.
I'm really excited to have you, and even more because this episode is going out on International Women's Day. So happy International Women's Day, my friend.
And to you, absolutely. And to everyone listening.
Amazing. I'm really excited to talk about Sophia because she's so important, so central to the continuation of the monarchy after the Stuarts. But I know so precious little about her. I'm really hoping you can bring her to life for me. So who was Sophia and how does the lineage connect her to the English throne?
Sophia is the woman who missed out on being our queen by a matter of a few weeks. She was the granddaughter of James VI and first via her mother, Elizabeth Stuart. So that made Charles II her cousin and at one point almost her husband.
Ooh.
Elizabeth Stuart then married Frederick, who has become the Elector Palatine, and Sophia was one of their children. So the couple became King and Queen of Bohemia for a super small period, which earned them the nickname the Winter King and Queen before the Holy Roman Emperor, Ferdinand II, came along and kicked them out into exile. And it was a loss that Elizabeth, in particular, always impressed upon her daughter. So she always impressed what they should have had and what they didn't have. And it made a massive impact in Sophia's own determination to build up her own family when she got the chance to make, if you like, the sort of comeback of all royal comebacks.
Gosh. So she's just putting her in more of my wheelhouse perspective. Is she the sister to Prince Rupert?
Yes, she would be.
Excellent. So he's Elizabeth's son. Yeah, okay. Yeah,
yes,
that works.
She would be, yeah. I was having to think sometimes these, particularly like in these group of families, that they're all called Sophia, George, or a variation on it. So sometimes I'm like, oh no, that was a different Phil, that was a different George, because there were like hundreds of them. But yeah,
it's the same, isn't it? Any period of history, it's like, can you just think of some more names? It's all Charles's, yeah. And James is where I am.
Yeah, and when you're writing about them, then, I mean, I wrote the biography of Sophia Dorothea, who was George I's wife, and then her mother-in-law is Sophia, her daughter is Sophia. There are various Sophia who are aunts and nieces, and it's like, oh, please, just once, can we do something that isn't Sophia? And they're like, no, sorry, we only have Sophias here.
I love this. So it's a sort of a long set of circumstances almost that lead to her becoming the heir presumptive over in Britain. How does this happen?
Well, it's the long game. I was going to say, it's one that you will be very familiar with. So obviously when James II came to the throne, his Catholicism made his reign a super short one. Mm-hmm. And we know the Glorious Revolution, which as a child, I was always like, what is this? What's the Glorious Revolution? And you sort of picturing, because in my head, I was like, it's the French Revolution, but I guess with more parties. But obviously, we know it wasn't, which swept the Catholic king into exile, lots of sweeping going on, and installed his daughter Mary and her husband William on the throne. Their marriage obviously ended up being childless, and Mary's sister Anne, who I'm sure you're super familiar with, was the heir. So though Anne did marry, she had terrible issues with fertility, and she endured, and I think endured is the word, 18 pregnancies, which obviously did appalling damage to her health, and I think her spirits and her mental health as well. And only one son survived, but he died in 1700, and this caused a bit of a kerfuffle because suddenly all of the heirs, I think it's 56 heirs to the throne, are all Catholic. So policymakers said we need to get something on paper. So they brought in the Act of Settlement, which basically leapfrogged all of those Catholic heirs to the very first Protestant on the list, and it was Sophia. And when we talk about a long game, Sophia was actually the 12th of 13 siblings, but they had all either died or they were Catholic and they were staunchly Catholic. And when they went and ticked all of those off, number 12 on the list was still alive. So it looked like Sophia was going to one day be king, despite being much older than Queen Anne, because she was what we would call robust. She was healthy. She was gunning for it as well. So at one point, she even went off for a secret meeting with William. She was off on holiday taking the water, and she heard that he was nearby in the Netherlands. So she took a detour to go and see him. And he actually suggested that he could perhaps managed to insinuate her ahead of Queen Anne. I'm
Wow.
not sure how he would have done it because we don't have anything written down, but she knew that that was really unlikely and that the worst outcome for that would be if you like almost to sort of push back against her. So she was happy to wait, and she was pretty sure that because of Anne's health that Anne would go first, but as we know, history proved her wrong.
Gosh. So in terms of their respective ages, how much is the difference between Anne and Sophia?
Well, Sophia would be born in, I'm that historian is terrible with dates. She was
Yeah, no.
1630. So when was Queen Anne? So it's a matter of decades.
Yeah, I was going to say this is a lot. So
Yeah, it's.
1630 puts her in the same generation as that's the same year as Charles II.
Yeah, so it
So
would
she's a
be.
generation above.
It's about, yeah, it's something like 34, 35 years between them. But Sophia had this really deep belief in her that one day she was going to get what her mother had always said would be her due. And I don't think, obviously, none of them ever thought what her due would be to be the queen.
Yeah.
But she was sort of told you were born to greatness, you know, we were monarchs and it was ripped away from us and all this kind of thing. And when she, what little was remains of Sophia, there are a few, you know, we get those sort of biographies or memoirs. We have her memoirs where she's really vibrant, alive woman, but she stops writing at a certain point. She stops writing before we get to the Act of Settlement. And her biographers remember her as being, well, when she found out that she was now in line of succession, very, very, very determined.
Yeah.
So she wasn't some like wilting or let, you know, God's will. She was like, yeah, this is going to happen. This, and as we'll get to, she started really agitating as well, agitating Queen Anne and niggling at her and getting her sort of on her back. And to me, she was like, she's such a forceful character who was, because of her circumstances, as listeners will know, you know, she was a woman in the era. So because of her circumstances, never really got a chance to show what I think she could have done. But she was very forceful, very determined, and very much sure that her fate would be to succeed.
Incredible. And I love that I think this is something that historians traditionally ignore or just don't give the credit that it deserves. I love that you suggest that it's her mother bringing her up in that way, and all of her mother's lived experience of being being a princess, being a queen, you're having this winter kingdom for a heartbeat, and having that so abruptly taken away from her, that then feeds into how this girl is raised, that you deserve better than this.
And Elizabeth spent a long time sort of agitating to try and get something. She was trying constantly to get the throne back, to get something back. You know, she did end up with her son succeed as elector, but she was constantly, she wasn't willing to just sit back and go, this was my fate. And we know that, you know, she was a thorn in all sorts of sides. But I guess also that looking back to England, she's seen the fate of the king in England, and I guess that almost lights a fire under you as well.
Yeah.
That this is that this, you know, almost like the sort of institutions are falling all over. And yeah, I don't think when I first started learning about Sophia, it was always through the lens of being the mother of George I and being the wife of this very obstinate, not terribly likable guy, Ernest Augustus, but being, she was just, as we all see in history, she was just the wife and the mother. And as if those roles couldn't in themselves embody someone who had power and had some influence that was curtailed because of her situation. But yeah, that she also had great friendships with women and niece, daughter, daughter-in-law. She had enormous, granddaughter-in-law, sorry, enormous, powerful friendships with women who she was always kind of pushing and challenging to do more, whether it be in their philosophical studies or in just the way they kind of lived life. That she learned from a strong woman, and I think that she tried to create strong women as well.
Amazing. Empowered women empower women. And any message at all for internet today,
100%.
It's that. So her relationships with women, these all sound very positive, very very constructive. What was her relationship like with Anne, Queen Anne of England? Did it influence how she played the game at all?
Yeah, it wasn't the greatest relationship. I think, you know, we all know Anne could be a bit thorny.
Okay.
And Sophia could be a bit thorny too, you know, just like they're human beings. So Sophia had really strong relations with William. And William had always said she was going to get an annuity and he was going to look after her, you know, so that when she finally, or when she became heiress, even if she never succeeded, she would be able to present herself as an heiress should. She came from a wealthy marriage anyway, but that she would, to the people of England, she would look like a future Queen of England, you know. But when he died, Anne said, yeah, we're not going to be paying you any annuity. We'll stay where you are. And if I die, that's when you'll get a call. So Anne was quite distrustful of Sophia. And a lot of that did come down to that friendship she'd had with William, which you can understand because gossip did get back to Anne that William had thought about sort of nudging her out. And it's not going to make for a happy, you know, a happy twosome. But they kind of semi got along until something happened where Sophia, I think, betrayed the fact that she hadn't been raised to be a politician, if you like. So although she'd been raised to about her birthright and how powerful women could be, she hadn't been sort of schooled in the delicate politics in the way that I think the male heirs were. So we have this invitation crisis, which basically came about when, as Sophia was getting more and more excited about her potential future, she started to travel a lot. She'd been widowed and she started going all over the place. She went to France to visit her niece and she went here and there. She went to the Netherlands. And then she thought how much she might like to go to England, which came over quite badly. So she started to create, via her ministers, good friends with some Whigs. And what she didn't reckon with was the infighting amongst the Whigs. So some of her Whig friends issued a pamphlet which criticised Queen Anne's Tory advisers and questioned their dedication to Protestant succession and others. And in all of the fallout, Lord Havisham suggested that in order to show that Queen Anne really did support her Hanoverian heirs, she should invite Sophia to move the entire court, lock, stock, and barrel, to England as a fully financed guest of the crown so she could settle before her inevitable succession.
Ooh, that's going to go down.
Yeah. Now it's a complete stirring of the pot, you know, because Havisham obviously had crossed the floor. So he was stirring the pot on all sides. But can you imagine basically saying to someone, look, we all know you're probably going to die quite young. So why don't you just invite your successor to come and sit on the edge of the stage?
Wow.
So Anne was fuming. And she was fuming because, on the one front, she suspected Sophia had put him up to it, which she actually hadn't. But she also knew that it would be, as we've seen throughout history, it would create a focus for anyone that wanted to stir the pot, anyone that wanted to be in opposition, that it would create, if you like, that alternative court, which we see constantly cropping up throughout the Georgian era when the sons are constantly setting up opposing courts to the dad. So she didn't quite fear a coup, but I think in the back of her mind, she knew that a coup was a possibility if Sophia was on the doorstep. It was just a bit of political mischief. And they set about trying to come up with something that would salve everybody, because at this point, Sophia's basically packing. So she's really into it. So the Whigs said, well, she doesn't need to come, but we could establish a regency council that will rule if Anne dies. So obviously, we don't want the Jacobites to come and take over while we wait for her to arrive from Hanover. But if we have a regency council, it'll all be quite smooth. But Sophia wasn't having it. She really wanted to come. So there was another pamphlet published in England, this one attacking the opponents of the invitation and saying, oh, you're all secret Jacobites. And Anne was, you know, it's not a very academic phrase, but Anne was raging.
Yeah.
She was livid. But she also knew that if she complained really loudly, people would say, oh, she doesn't support it. She doesn't support the Hanoverian succession. So what do you do? And what made matters worse was Sophia's old friend, philosopher Gottfried Leibniz, leaked a letter written by Sophia in which she said she'd love to come to England. And she's super keen to do it, but obviously only if Anne will let her come. And she doesn't blame Anne for a minute. She knows it's politicians who are to blame. So in the end, Anne dispatched the Duke of Marlborough and a whole delegation to Hanover to personally hand over the Regency Act. It was to induct her son George into the Order of the Garter, and it was to create her grandson, later George II, as Duke of Cambridge. So all of it was intended to make it look as though there's a huge amount of support, but you don't need to come here to get it. And even that went badly because Sophia had to pay, obviously, to host the delegation, and she had to give them presents, and she said their presents were a bit cheap. And at one point, she got up, apparently ran out of the room, and they realized they'd accidentally seated her right opposite a portrait of the pretender to the throne. And all. So it was chaos. And then the little coda to this is Sophia had got very friendly with Caroline of Ansbach. And Caroline said, oh, well, actually, you know, since my husband is now Duke of Cambridge, could you ask Queen Anne if he can go and sit in the House of Lords? So it was just chaos upon chaos upon chaos. Now, interestingly, she did ask Queen Anne, and Anne sent back a letter which was furious, basically saying, in very polite Queen Anne-ish terms, you're not welcome, don't come. He's not welcome. We don't want any of you here. And Sophia died a few days later. And people then went on to say, oh, she killed her. It was the shock of the letter killed her. So their relationship was not, it was a long way to answer the question, sorry, but the relationship was, it was basically non-existent until the succession became an issue. And then it was just antagonism. And it was antagonism from all sides. And, you know, we see it today when a source leaks something. So sources were leaking left, right, and centre. And Sophia just sat in Hanover with half her bags packed, waiting for Queen Anne to go, do you know what? You should come. Like, here's the house, here's the castle. You should totally come and just sit right behind me waiting for me to die. But that never happened.
I mean, of course, she's being caught up in so much politicking, but I mean, for Anne, if you think about sort of just Sophia's very existence as a thing, it's not only a reminder that she's going to die, but it's a reminder that all of her children have died,
Exactly that.
and a kind of almost like a badge of monarchical and dynastic failure.
Yes. And I've seen some kind of like, just, when you kind of go around the internet looking at stuff, the kind of like sense, well, what do you expect with two women? Women niggling at women. But it's not. It's exactly as you said. It's a reminder, firstly, that even as a relatively young woman, you're not expected to live very long. When you're staring your own mortality in the face, you've seen your children die, you know how you have suffered. And to know that people are not showing any compassion or empathy, but are basically starting to line their own nests and starting to use that suffering as a pivot point for their own mischief making, because that's what it mostly was. And it's, to me, it was so frustrating, not just as a woman, but just as someone who has a sense of, I think, as compassion, to see it dismissed as, well, oh, it was, I think someone even described it as like bitchy backbiting, as if, kings never
No.
get into this sort of thing. No. But as you're quite right, it's a reminder of your own mortality, of these horrendous losses you've suffered, of the impact it's had on your own health. And I don't think anybody wants someone sitting a few feet, well, not literally, but a few feet behind them,
Yeah.
waiting for them to die. Yeah, and also, that person is going to be, even if they are completely benign and just do nothing, just by being there, they're going to create a situation for you. Because there are people all around you who are going, well, I need to leg up and I need to make sure I'm in the right position. And it's, I think Anne was between a rock and a hard place. And I think that Sophia, to me, wasn't motivated by, and this is not me saying it, but female backbiting. But I think she couldn't believe that she was that close. And that she did have this genuine fear that if Anne did die and she was in Hanover, that in the time it took her to get to England, she'd lose it. And that she had to, if she wasn't almost literally on the doorstep of the throne, that in those weeks, this thing that she almost had felt she owed, I think, her mother and her bloodline would be gone. So it wasn't, oh, I'm going to go and sit there and be a thorn in her side. It was like, I'm going to go, so I'm there.
Yeah. And if anything, she'd seen from her mother's experience how quick things can turn.
Exactly.
It's not, it's not months, it's minutes how
You can
quick
lose
things.
it when you've got it. You can lose it in the blink of an eye.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely incredible. Now, you mentioned to me that Sophia she's like a character out of EastEnders, and she's all about her family.
Is.
So that's my terrible EastEnders impression. So how did that affect Sophia's kind of workings, her policies, and how she structured everything?
Sophia's quite an interesting figure, and I think to sort of understand how she became first the Duchess and then the Electress, we sort of have to understand this strange early history that she had. So I think we quite often tend to think of brides of the era of kind of growing up in kind of isolated splendor, getting married off to someone, and then they. But Sophia had a really, really disjointed childhood. So as we know, she was kind of spirited into exile. She was in a very strange situation because her family did manage to take the crown jewels with them, but they had no actual ready cash. And there was a little note where she said that in her own memoirs, we had nothing to eat but diamonds and pearls. So they were actually really beholden to charity of other powerful people. And her mother was quite a talented political woman, but obviously on limited resources. So eventually it was decided that Sophia would go and live with her brother. And her brother had married him, his at the time great love. And they had a super passionate but very toxic relationship. So when Sophia arrived, she found this couple where he had a trap door and a ladder, and in the room above the trap door was his mistress, and his wife was once caught climbing the ladder with a dagger between her teeth, and she nearly bit the mistress's finger. She bit it right through in a fight, and it was a really tumultuous court.
Wow.
But Sophia's brother came to rely on her to a ridiculous degree, and he would always be with her. And then, of course, comes what we see throughout history: allegations of incest, and yeah, not true. But Sophia wasn't a young teen now. She's into her 20s, and she was just really keen to start her own life, and she wanted to be rid of all this, and she wanted stability. So a suggestion came up that she would marry the brother of the Swedish king. It was a really good marriage in terms of dynasty and in terms of cash, but Sophia hated him. He was not a likable character. She did, I hate to comment on his looks, but he was described as having a face like a shoehorn, which I just think is one of my favorites. And
Oh
when it's just when you see him, he actually does. And we've spoken about how it's you have to sort of imagine people
gosh.
before we could see them in film and photos, but he actually does have a face like a shoehorn. So she didn't want to
Amazing.
marry him.
You don't want to marry a shoehorn,
She
no.
didn't want to marry a shoehorn, but she'd also become friends with these two brothers from Hanover, who were George William and Ernest Augustus, and they were two of four dukes who split the Hanoverian duchies between them. But the wedding was going ahead, the wedding outfits were ordered, and all of this. But the King of Sweden, Charles Gustav, hadn't yet agreed. And this was because he was in talks with old Cromwell.
Ah.
And Cromwell had suggested that a marriage between the Swedish royal family and the cousin of Charles II, niece of Charles I, well, obviously it wasn't Charles II, might not
Yeah.
create good feeling between the protectorate and Sweden. So it gave everyone a get out. So she got out of the marriage to the man she never wanted to marry.
Brilliant.
And Charles got out of creating a situation between Sweden and Cromwell. And Sophia said, and Sophia's brother said, is there anyone that you'd like to marry? Which is quite unusual for the time.
Yeah.
So she said, well, these two brothers, I think it is like EastEnders, isn't it? These two brothers.
Either or
Oh,
both.
God. So one of the brothers, George William, who was very go-getting, and I think he would have come across as very superficially charming. So he's the life and soul of the party. And he told her that he loved her. And Sophia was like, yes, I'll marry him. Him, thank you. So she's getting ready to marry George William. But George William keeps going to Italy with his brother. And when he's in Italy, all the stories come back is that basically he's just in and out of every other bed. He's rip raw, all those like the Usain Blackadder roister doister in, all kind of thing. And George William then realized he didn't actually want to get married. But what he wanted was the money he would get if he did get married. Ernest Augustus, on the other hand, his brother, did want to get married because he had started to think that rather than carve up the estates four ways, or they could carve up the estates four ways, but they should only carve up the power one way, and that was to him. So he thought, well, if I'm the one that's married, and if I get an heir, I've got a really good argument for me being the guy who controls everything. So he said to his brother, I could marry if you want, and I can just talk to the people, I can just talk to the ministers, and you get the money. And so basically he sold her. So George William said, yeah, all right, that you marry her. And they asked Sophia, but I think by this point it was pretty much a done deal, because you'll know as well, there's only so many times you can break an engagement before the woman is
Yeah.
seen as unmarriageable. So he passed her off to Ernest Augustus. Now, there's a weird little coda to this story. which is that when the brothers met to sign over the agreement of marriage that basically transferred the promise, another brother got really turned up in an absolute state, Charles, and said, "Well, I'm one of the brothers too, and I didn't know she was on offer. And if I'd known she was on offer, I would have put in a better offer."
Oh my
And he
God.
and Ernest Augustus actually had a physical fight over the signing of the document. Well, apparently George William was standing there laughing at it all because he didn't really care. Sophia's take on it was that she wanted to get married because she wanted to get out of this situation she was in with this warring couple.
Yeah.
She wanted to set up her own household. She did have dynastic ambitions, so she knew marrying someone who was, that Hanover wasn't an electorate then, but it was a long process to get there. They were already talking about it. And Ernest Augustus could trace his bloodlines through the House of Welf, so obviously it goes back, a long, long way. So she said okay. And when she married Ernest Augustus, she found herself in another crazy situation. So he was madly jealous, and he was convinced that she was having it away with the brother who had basically sold her. So we have this ridiculous situation where when he wanted to nap, which he did every afternoon, he made her sit in a chair, and then he put his feet on either side of sat opposite with his feet on either arm of her chair and went to sleep. So she had to just sit there because she couldn't move because she would wake him up.
Wow.
So it takes it to a whole new level. But then on the other hand, she had George William, the brother who'd given her away, who used to come to her room every single morning while she was still in bed. And she'd sit and chat to her in the presence of her lady, so it was all above board. And then she'd say, "You have to leave because I'm getting dressed." And then without fail, he would come back in like 10 minutes later trying to catch her naked. And it's just this horrible, icky situation where the brothers were chummy as anything and went off again, kept going off traveling together, still having plenty of mistresses and all this. But Sophia, I think, learned from that I think she had quite a strong sense that sometimes men are really ridiculous. But she also learned that she was better to Ernest Augustus had these ideas, if you like, which my grandma's always got these ideas. So she focused herself on her domestic sphere. So she didn't really have any say and any influence in terms of the policies that Ernest Augustus and his brothers were making, but she absolutely focused on her own family, on building that family, and on building, when she had her children, a dynasty. So George the First eventually, as we know, had a disastrous marriage, but Sophia brokered the marriage. And it's quite interesting that here we see, and I think going through history and royal history, quite often we see that women were able to intervene or have an impact on marriages where they couldn't elsewhere. So George William eventually decided to marry, despite having signed a document saying he never would. And he actually married a woman who he'd previously installed as one of Sophia's ladies in waiting. Sophia hated her because she thought she wasn't worthy of, marrying into their dynasty. But he married this woman, Eleanor. And they had a daughter, Sophia Dorothea. And so there was a funny division here because Hanover, Ernest Augustus's territory, had all the power, but Celle, George William's territory, had all the money.
Ah.
So he had a daughter who was technically illegitimate because the wedding was a morganatic one, technically legitimate, but one day would come into a vast fortune. And also, of course, would come into a really important part of the Hanoverian territories. So she would have made a perfect wife for Sophia's son, George.
Right.
So they would get all the money back into Hanover, all the territory back. So she was legitimized, yada, yada, yada. But obviously, because Sophia Dorothea was one day going to be worth a fortune, she had suitors at her door literally when she was like 7 years old. And Sophia, remembering that George William had always carried a torch for her, decided to play on it. So she started to become very friendly to her brother-in-law suddenly, and not in any sexual or intimate sense, but to basically leverage that influence that she knew she'd had on him in the past, and to kind of like over the years drip feed. Wouldn't it be nice? Imagine that, we couldn't be together because ultimately we both found other people, but our children could be. They could realize that dream. And on the day Sophia Dorothea turned 16, Sophia was at the door, literally at 5 a.m., knocking on the door. She went in, she went straight up to the marital bedroom, and George William and Eleanor were in bed. She got George William out of bed. Now, I think it speaks a lot of the fact that she could command people that he jumped out of bed, pulled on his banyan, went into the dressing room with her, and they had a conversation in Dutch, which Eleanor didn't speak. And the conversation was basically brokering the marriage of Sophia Dorothea with Sophia's son George. And by the time Sophia left, they were betrothed.
Wow.
And she'd done it all without her husband. She'd done it all without, we normally see all this back and forth of papers and promises and contracts and ministers. She didn't. She went into a dressing room. She was in there for a couple of hours just making a case. And she came out, job, job done.
Absolutely incredible.
And it obviously ended terribly. But through that marriage, we see George II becomes, the child of that marriage. So she was very, very single-minded. And she involved herself constantly in that marriage. And she did try to make it work. So George had a mistress. And on the day that Sophia Dorothea arrived, the mistress was still at court, and Sophia had her sent into exile. So she did involve herself. And she had, from childhood, a huge amount of influence over her son. And he looked to her for many, many decisions. Now, interesting, that influence did wane after the disaster of the Invitation Crisis. But as he was preparing first to succeed his father as elector, then preparing for the long road to the crown of England, Sophia was constantly influencing him. Not, we don't see her influencing him in terms of actual policy making, but just in terms of shaping how he looked at the world. And his interactions and his sense of destiny, of this is your right. The sense of that with regard to Hanover came from his father, but the sense of it with regard to this is your right because this is your bloodline came from her.
Wow. It's absolutely incredible just that she can completely shape the world to her vision and how she wants it to be. Does she become electress on marrying, or is that something that comes
No,
later with her
it
husband?
came much, much later. On marrying, she became the a duchess,
Yeah.
but she became electorate. I'm just checking my date, sorry.
It's
I'm
okay.
terrible. I am, people think if you do history, you should be like that with dates. I am not.
Oh, I'm awful with numbers.
Same, 1692. I did an interview a couple of weeks ago, and someone asked me someone's age at the time, and I was like, somewhere between 20 and 40.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a fairly long road. And what was interesting is that when he, it was about a dozen years or more before she became electress, and she supported Ernest Augustus all the way to becoming electorate, but she also supported, or appeared to, when he made a move to introduce primogeniture in Hanover. Because he had become, if you like, the person that's going to become the elector, because he had managed to pay off some brothers. So George William was paid off. He paid off some brothers, others died, until he was like the one of the four who became the elector. But he had sons of his own. And obviously, then we have the issue of four sons who, again, could split the territory. And obviously, it's like having a kingdom ruled by four kings.
Yeah.
So he decided to introduce primogeniture. And what was interesting about this is that Sophia initially supported it, but then actually, after speaking to her sons, began to worry about the impact it would have on the family. So although she was very ambitious for a family, she also didn't want it to split apart. And again, I think that that's probably quite natural anyway for a parent. But we've seen through history, you know, monarchs who are quite happy to split their own families up or to cause enormous ructions. But I think because her family had been shattered so early and, you know, variously people had died, been sent to convents, been sent here and there and everywhere, that she didn't want her sons to end up fractured from the family.
Yeah.
So she actually got herself into the only bit of close to real trouble we see, in that when Ernest Augustus said he wanted to introduce primogeniture, he obviously, George was great, very happy about this because George was the eldest son. The second son was understandably not, because he knew what he was going to miss out on. He knew that basically he would still get all the money, but he would have none of the power. And Sophia sided with him. And then it came out that he had was going to attempt a coup. It was a conspiracy. He was exiled, but Sophia was actually tried before her husband and the court to determine. It wasn't, you know, really formal proceeding, but she was essentially tried to determine if she had known about the conspiracy, if she had sheltered the son who was going to commit the coup, and if she had funded his friends. Now, she was found innocent. But what was interesting is that she never denied that she, in principle, she could understand where they were coming from. So she said, you know, I understand in the interests of Hanover and the electorate and da 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 that we can't split it. But in principle, I don't think it's right. So that, to me, it's almost the voice of a mother, that we know Ernest Augustus could be a really vindictive man. He could be a really unpleasant character to deal with. But interestingly, when she said that, although he was furious at what was perceived as, you know, she should have sided with him, he also actually respected it, because he respected that she had, if you like, had the balls to say,
yeah,
I didn't shelter them, I don't support it, I wouldn't in practice support any sort of a coup, but in principle, I could totally understand where they're coming from. And it's a completely different wife we see to, you know, George I's wife, and through no fault of their own, but plenty of other spouses, that she knew there was a lot at stake. And we also know, because later we see her daughter-in-law in prison for 30 years. So she knew that really there was a lot at stake here. But I think she also knew, firstly, that her husband did really respect her, which he did. We know that Ernest Augustus respected her tremendously, despite his dalliances. But that, to her, that principle was strong enough. But I think as well, we also see in it the ambition that she supports in principle, but she's not going to do anything that could ultimately, because ultimately you start to see a duchy like that start to come apart. People are going to come from all sides to start carving it up. So I think she understood the importance of, firstly, one ruler, hence primogeniture. And regardless of what in principle you might think, in practice, you push the family forward and you push the line forward, and you don't let the third brother or the second brother start raising a ruckus. You keep it down one line all the way along the family tree. So she had that real steadiness of purpose. But I think this whole potential coup thing was the only place where she very nearly could have come unstuck.
Incredible. I mean, talk about a singular vision, and having to make some very tough choices. We need to skip forward a little bit. So we're coming to the end of Sophia's life. So when she dies in 1714, what happens? I mean, it's all kind of, it's a done deal. She's meant to be the heir. Anne's meant to die first.
Yeah.
What's going on now?
What happens, sadly, is what George always kind of expected would happen. George just sat there sucking it all in, letting her fall out with people, letting her, I think through her sort of like trouble with the invitation crisis, her son was able to get the measure of what the characters were in England.
Yeah.
So he wasn't involved. He did that thing where he was like, oh no, you know, I'm just watching it happen. George, if you look at George's early life, particularly as well, when his wife was arrested, her lover was murdered, George was never involved. He was always, and he actually wasn't, but he was always just there watching it, taking it all in. And you know, in that way, some people do that, they take it all in and then they move in and clean it up. So George took it all in, and we know it didn't go too well when he did move into, you know, he arrived in England and there was a bit of a tumult. But what happened was, pretty much, you know, it's like William IV always said, didn't he, that he'd live long enough to see Queen Victoria come of age. Queen Anne lived long enough to see Sophia buried, or see Sophia die. And then Queen Anne went, okay, I can go. And George I, as if his mother had never existed, packed up his 100 German courtiers, packed up his trunks, and set sail. And Sophia missed it by weeks, not even months, weeks. I bet she was sat wherever she went going, oh, I can't believe it. Oh.
A couple of weeks later, Anne sort of turns up at the, gates of St. Peter's, and Sophia's there. Imagine that conversation.
Tapping a foot.
Where have you been?
It feels like the worst punchline in royal history, doesn't it?
Oh my
That
goodness.
you never thought you'd get it. Then you're sort of rubbing your hands because all these 50 Catholics, ha 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 ha, we're going to get it now. They're all gone, I'm going to get it. And then suddenly, yeah, you know. And I don't think it had anything to do with the nasty letter from Queen Anne, but oh God, imagine if it did.
My God. So she's, like you say, she, it's all kind of lined up. It's a done deal. 50 people are scratched off the list above her, like in some sort of Kind Hearts and Coronets or Uncle Buck
I love that, yeah.
scenario. Is she remembered today? I mean, I know we've dedicated this episode to her. You've written about her, we're talking about her. But is she remembered, or is she commemorated? Here, Germany, do they talk about her contributions to?
She pops up here and there, but she only pops up in regard to, you'll see the odd portrait of her in things like the Royal Collection, but it's always mother of George I. She's remembered in Germany, but she's remembered, it's, you know, she would love it, but she's remembered as the woman who masterminded the beautiful gardens and estates at Herrenhausen.
Okay.
So, because she was a great, you know, great philosophy student and absolutely devoted to botany, and she and her husband transformed Herrenhausen into like a beautiful place. And the grounds, I've never been, but I'd love to go. Apparently, the grounds are exquisite. So she's remembered very much for that. That's probably her greatest legacy. But in England, sadly, she's not. I did see mention of her at an exhibition a few years ago, but they'd wrongly credited her as, I think it was, I can't remember now, but the wife or mother of George III. So she was completely wrongly committed, and it was in a place that should have known better. And when I emailed them, they said, oh, sorry, but we hope you enjoyed the exhibition. It's like, but change it. So she's not, and it's a shame because I just feel like she should have been. She should be, because I don't know, it feels like she strove to keep this pretty atrocious Adams family type group of people together. Actually, the Adams family more lovable than the Hanoverians, but this group of people, she had this mistress who was fingers in every pie, her husband's mistress, who was mixing up trouble, you know, conspiring to murder people. Da, 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 da. And she went through all of this with grace and dignity. Little story there, really quick. The husband's mistress was known for her very rich dresses and her face full of makeup. So Sophia, she was Sophia's lady in waiting. And Sophia used to make her accompany her on brisk walks around the garden in high summer. And Sophia would appear wearing just like, you know, a light walking dress and no makeup. And she'd say to her, well, you should make sure you get dressed up because you might see my husband. So Clara would slap on all the makeup. And apparently her makeup would be like melting off her face. She
Brilliant.
followed Sophia. But yeah, she's very little known in England, sadly. Very, very little known. And she should be better known.
She should. I ask everybody this, Catherine, so I am going to ask you. Sophia's been overlooked. She's been ignored. She's been forgotten. And she's been misunderstood and miscredited, which is just lazy. So if you had just a few seconds to reintroduce Sophia, Electress of Hanover, to the world, what would you say?
I'd say she was one of the finest queens that we never had. and a woman who absolutely should be remembered and celebrated because she was a heck of a character.
Incredible. Thank you so much for joining me today, Catherine Curzon. Where can we follow your most glamorous adventures on Twitter?
You can follow me at Madame Gilflirt, although any search for Frocking Fabulous, or actually Dean Martin, should find me.
And I'm very grateful to you for the regular Cary Grant photos.
Oh yes, my pleasure. Cary Grant Wednesday.
Thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books, you can support them, and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.